welcome to Casual Trek. My name is Miles Reed Lobato, writer and general science fiction fan. Now, Charlie, how old were you in the year 1999?
I was 19.
I would have been 16 in the year 1999. Now, Charlie, do you remember what happened on September 13th, 1999?
You mean, like, when the moon got shot off into space?
Yeah, a huge nuclear explosion took place on the moon, hurtling it and an entire moon base of people far across the galaxy at incredible speeds, if you think about it.
Yeah, it was impressive. Took all of our minds off of the Millennium Bug.
In this alternate timeline when this happened, I clearly must have thought it was like a bad E-trip.
God, I probably was working in the comic shop when that happened.
So this week we are doing something a little bit different. After last week's episode of talking about cosmic horror in Star Trek, I mentioned, hey, we should watch another space opera which has a lot of cosmic horror elements. And so I kind of forced Charlie to watch some episodes of the 1975 TV series Space 1999. And because we'll never get hashtag Blake's Boys, for once, we're going to get hashtag Space Scamps.
Yep. Yeah, we are Space Scamps for an episode.
But in keeping with our usual Casual Trek tradition, Charlie, what non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying this week?
It'd be really easy to go Space 1999, but I'll resist. I will say that after a harrowing few days of thinking my Switch was bricked, my partner Emma managed to just look at it and it behaved itself. And I had a look at their summer sale and Balatro was an offer. And Balatro has me now. I am behind on some of my UK Games Expo reporting because I have been Balatro for a few days now. It's a roguelike game about making poker hands. And as a recovering CCG addict and someone who, I don't care for poker, I've got the worst poker face ever. I'm used to poker hands through the Doomtown collectible card game and Deadlands, the equivalent role-playing game. So I'm used to what the hands are. But this, like, you get jokers which modify what the game does, and you can modify cards which crumple them up but make them lucky. You've got things which, like, just the escalation and the madness of it all, even though it is just using a deck of cards. Admittedly, it could be a deck of cards with, like, 25 diamonds in it, and, you know, suddenly things all trigger off each other. Some of the cards are made of glass and shatter, some are stone. It's very stupid and worryingly Moorish. So yeah, that's what's been occupying my time. And Miles, what about you?
And also, as easy as it would be to say Space 1999 is my non-Star Trek thing I've been enjoying this last week, I and my wife finally got to go and see Furiosa, a Mad Max saga.
Ooh.
It was a lot of fun. Chris Hemsworth almost steals the show as the villainous Dementus, and I don't think last time I saw him having this much fun may have been where he was playing the himbo secretary in the 2016 Ghostbusters films, which, despite what the internet will tell you, I would say is a solid, like, B-, and not the worst thing to ever happen to popular culture. It's very different. Furiosa is very different from the other Mad Max films, in which it takes the term saga actually a far more literally than I thought it was going to be. It takes place over, like, I think 15 to 20 years and is divided into chapters, Tarantino style.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Fury Road. The Mad Max films I've mostly seen in pieces. I think the first one I saw kind of occasionally, bit by bit, over a New Year's Eve when my dad was wandering back and forth having some kind of dramatic chat with his girlfriend at the time, and my brother and I were ducking into the other room in the flat, one of which was playing, the first Mad Max.
Okay.
So I've seen maybe half of it. And yeah, loved Fury Road. It was my third date with Emma when that was in the cinema. And yeah, such a good movie. So I'm pleased to hear this one's been good fun.
I think my third date movie with Rihanna was the King Kong remake with Peter Jackson, because of the long distance thing. Like, seeing films gets weirdly intermittent. The first film, our first like date movie, was Day After Tomorrow, which I don't know if I've talked about the experience of watching on this podcast, but for like the first hour or so of Day After Tomorrow, there's a collection of British people in a shack who are slowly going to freeze to death. And since this is a Roland Emmerich joint, you know they're going to be the most stereotypically cliched British people dying in a shack ever. So while this film is trying for maximum pathos, I'm pissing myself laughing. And there's a point where the British royal family die in a frozen helicopter crash. This is the point where I'm now just cackling like a crazy person.
Well, yeah.
And the lady, and this is in America, this is in small town Midwest America, and this lady turns from in front of me, turns to me, and if looks could kill, I would be a dead man. So I had to sheepishly apologize and shuffle to the end of the aisle so I could continue to cackle insanely.
Excellent. I assume they had the most stiff upper lips while they were freezing to death.
That the last line of the British people, I believe it's Ian Holm or one of those British character actors. Hmm. Their last line is a toast to Manchester United, and like I'm just like I'm done. This broke me.
Oh dear, that's horrifying. So yeah, I'm pleased Furiosa was better than that.
Yeah, Furiosa was a lot of fun. If you go, I'm gonna say if you go in expecting Fury Road -1 or Fury Road 2.0, if you're expecting like a 2 hour long chase scene, you're going to be very disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very kind of slow burn, similar in some ways, I would say, to the original Mad Max.
Okay.
In which a character basically slow burn loses everything and has no real recourse of action but just to descend into revenge.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a good film. Anya Taylor-Joy did a lot despite having like a minimum of like I think 30 or 25 lines.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a good film.
Yeah, well, and from apocalyptic Australia to space.
To space.
Space.
We'll go unaffected by capitalism. Space.
And sadly, that's not even the case anymore, thanks to billionaires with their spaceship dreams.
Yeah.
Yep. So why is Space 1999? Like, this is a Gerry Anderson joint. You were saying it's from the 70s. I started watching it and bits looked like it was directed for puppets. What is this thing's deal?
Well, apparently it was the most, at the time, expensive TV series ever made in England, with a budget of like 6.8 million.
Wow.
And you can kind of see it. It is the second of the two. Gerry Anderson is most famous for like doing like the Thunderbirds, Stingray, Captain Scarlet, Super Mario Nation puppet shows. If you're one of our American listeners, the stuff they're doing in Team America, but done seriously and with less vomit jokes.
Yeah.
I guess after a while, like, Gerry Anderson was like, I'm done with puppets. I want to make serious live action people. And it's like, great. Can you actually give them more character, or are the puppets going to be more expressive? And the puppets are sadly more expressive. I guess Gerry Anderson never really got the how to direct or, you know, like have actual characters.
Yeah, as much as I enjoyed this show, there wasn't a massive amount for characters. Admittedly, there were a lot of people that felt like they were just there for one sitting and done, or there in the background. So for the people at home who don't know what Space 1999 is, God help us, some of whom may have been born after 1999, what's the elevator pitch?
Okay, so there in the year 1999, there is a moon base called Moon Base Alpha. And the moon has a problem in which they've been storing a shit ton of nuclear waste in dumps on the moon because it's safer than dumping nuclear waste on Earth. And it turns out, yeah, when you leave all this nuclear waste in these dump sites and these basically these landfills on the moon, it's going to cause madness-inducing plague, as we see in the first episode, Breakaway, and then eventually it's going to set off a massive nuclear reaction so powerful that it's going to knock the moon out of orbit and then send it hurtling through deepest space at incredible speeds, because they leave our solar system, I think it's like in a week. And then they're just traveling through solar systems and galaxies at incredible speeds. And from then, it's basically Star Trek, but on the moon.
Yeah.
With a very British sensibility and tone.
And yeah, like the moon is constantly moving because, you know, that's how momentum works in space, really. So I guess anything that they come across, they need to deal with and get back on the moon before it goes.
There is the implication that they're looking for somewhere which is more habitable than the moon, which is A, very limited in supplies, and B, not a noted social venue for starting a new colony. The possibility that Earth might have been devastated is very much glossed over.
Yeah. Yeah, I did write on my notes, like, what's going to happen to Earth here? And there is a short newscaster thing going, oh, oceans have gone a bit weird. It's like, yeah, we do need a moon, right?
The moon is there for, like, I know... Like, despite what the flat earthers think, the moon's quite important to how the day-night cycle and the tides work.
Yeah, so I've seen, you gave me a short list of 5 episodes. In none of these does it answer what happened to Earth. Does it ever say what happened to Earth?
I don't think it does. I know there is one episode, which I didn't put on a list, which has Christopher Lee in it.
Oh,
playing
wow.
Playing an alien with some fantastic glam rock eye makeup. And I know you asked me what happens to Gorski, who is the original moon commander, before our hero John Koenig, played by Mission Impossible's and Edward's Martin Landau, is thrust into the command position. And to answer your question to what happens to the original moon base commander, these aliens are going to Earth, but because of the huge distance, they are in suspended animation capsules, and they have room for one person. And the moment Gorski realizes, wait, I could go back home and sleep the rest of the way, he basically blackmails, threatens, cajoles his way into the one spot in the suspended animation capsule, and gets a free trip back to Earth. But unfortunately, due to his human physiognomy, he wakes up in the suspended animation capsule literally, I'd say, about an hour after leaving, and so is trapped in a small glass cube with the rest of the crew still in suspended animation. So whatever happens to Gorski, he gets, like, cask of Montiardos in space.
Hello, this is Miles coming to you from the editing booth, which is actually the desk in my bedroom, to issue a correction. When Miles is talking about the character Gorski, he's actually referring to the character of Simmons, who comes to a rather nasty end in the episode Earthbound, which guest stars Christopher Lee. Simmons is played by actor Roy Dotrice, who a lot of us will know as being the audiobook reader for George R.R. Martin's Game of Thrones books. Anyway, back to the show.
Nice. So, yeah, in case you couldn't tell from that, Cosmic Horror, this show which I assume was for children, has a lot of this kind of bullshit going on. Yeah.
This is kind of the two issues with Space 1999 and its previous series, UFO, which was another live action Gerry Anderson science fiction adventure, is that the show is being written and approached, I'm guessing, for like, Gerry Anderson wanted to make proper adult drama, but because he was the Thunderbirds guy, the TV channels just assumed, oh yeah, this is for kids. Kids will love this. And despite the cosmic horror, I would say the aesthetics of Moonbase and how it's approached is very Space 2001, a space odyssey.
Yeah, I was thinking that, like, the civilized areas of that with very white walls and, you know, the occasional splash of, like, an orange or anything, very 70s kind of vibe, but in space.
You can tell that the money was well spent because it does look a lot nicer than, well, okay, let's be honest, compared to 70s Doctor Who, this, in terms of budget and production value, this basically drags Doctor Who out behind the bike sheds, makes fun of it for being poor, beats it up, and steals its milk money, which is what Doctor Who had a budget of this week.
Yes. Yeah, it definitely had that feeling. We've got 5 episodes that we're going to cover. A little briefer, a bit more casual than our normal Star Trek style. But first of all, like, who are these people? Who are the characters? You mentioned Commander John Koenig, played by Martin Landau. And the thing I noticed in these episodes is he must never be wrong.
No.
He never seems to be happy or having fun, but he will be, like, right. And that felt odd because even Kirk has his moments of wrong, of like, oh yeah, oh, he goofed about things, or his arrogance. But Koenig is far too, I don't know, almost like your old Lost in Space characters, that kind of classic sci-fi hero man.
I think in a way, kind of like Adama in the reboot of Battlestar Galactica, where it's like, we have a crew of like 300 people and we are fucked. So we want to make sure that we are as fucked as little as possible. And so, yeah, Koenig is a little intense in how he does his, job.
Yeah.
Like, I would say that unlike Kirk, who is, you know, because these people aren't explorers or pioneers, they're basically office workers on the moon.
Yeah.
Who have been like promoted into, hey, you get to be pulp sci-fi heroes now. And Koenig is just like, yeah, but I still have to have my human resources department file the reports about paperclip wastage. Like, you know, Koenig has had to have several meetings about, wage theft in the workplace. You know, whereas like Kirk is like the swashbuckling, I am a cowboy in space. Koenig is basically, yeah, I am middle management in space.
Yeah. And then there's Dr. Helena Russell, and out of the core kind of trio of characters, you can tell which one she is because she's the girl one.
She's our Dr. Crusher of the show. So she is there to present what small amount of human emotion gets displayed because she is the woman.
Yeah. Yeah. And then finally, there's Victor Bergman, who is the other man. That's pretty much all I have notes wise for him.
He is science guy.
He has beard.
He's old and does science.
Yeah. Yeah. And these three will be our main kind of perspective on some weird, weird space bullshit. And it's that kind of thing where watching it, I was engrossed and there was a lot of entertaining madness, even though the characters really didn't grasp me much. Yeah. And while you've got a few people in that kind of bridge crew, most of the people that I saw in these five episodes, I only saw once. And I assume a lot of them are like that. Of like, yeah,
We have just like, I think you have like a core, like main mission is like the bridge of the moon base. Mm. And it's just kind of like, they're there. I kind of recognize them because, you know, you have one has a very 70s-tastic porn stash. So I recognize that guy immediately because he has the porn stash. And yeah. One has an Aussie accent and he's like the pilot.
Yeah. Like,
it doesn't help that they're all called like Nick and they're all called like Paul and Adam and just very kind of, you know, normal people names.
Yeah, I appreciated that, but also it didn't help distinguishing them, especially because everyone's kind of in the same sort of outfits.
Yeah.
Whether it's on board or out in space in a very toyetic spacesuit. And in the first episode, in a buggy that looks so small, it looked like a really cheap action figure kind of buggy that two people were kind of squished in. Like, if it took a corner too quickly, at least one of them's bailing out.
I think that it definitely operates in, like, early Halo's buggy physics.
Yeah.
The special effects... Mm. Which are all done by all the veterans of these of the show of the Gerry Anderson puppet shows, who will then go on to do stuff work for the Bond films. I think it's the same FX team which does the destruction of Krypton in the 70s Superman movie, and gave us the Eagle, which not the British comic for young boys, which gave us Dan Dare, Pilot of the Future, but possibly I would say one of the cooler looking. Spaceships in TV SF-dom. The Eagle, kind of the shuttle they have.
Right, yes. Yeah, I liked the kind of the aesthetic of it all. It felt not quite alien level, but there was definitely that vibe. God, one of the episodes we saw, I'm trying to remember now, Dragon's Domain had a spaceship graveyard. And it felt very reminiscent of a role-playing game I'm a big fan of called Mothership. And I had to race to the internet to see if their bingo card of references mentioned Space 1999, because so much of this felt like that. And I think when I run it again, I will probably steal a lot of the Space 1999 aesthetic.
Oh dear.
For the interiors, because... Yeah, it's very alien, very this kind of like, yeah, people have flares and that, but there is an airlock that will kill you and the sticker covering it up saying danger is really flimsy. So we've covered the characters. I guess if we get into the episodes, you've pretty much described Breakaway, the pilot.
Yeah.
In the pitch. Is there anything else that needs to be said aside from... I did love that they had a corporate weasel. Like, I love a good weasel character in horror or anything, really. And he had that, like, Zachary Smith, he would sell everyone out for a slightly more comfortable life kind of vibe.
Yeah, he's definitely a guy who would screw everyone over if it means his office chair got wheels.
Exactly. Yeah, when I'm on my notes, I have, who are these people? But I was trying to write down any names and crossed a few off as well. And at first for him, I just had guy on screen with necktie. Evil?
He was very evil coded. Is that our British class sensibilities at work in which we see someone in a necktie and not like a fun, colourful necktie, but like a black necktie? We immediately think either evil or scar player.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. The only other option's probably, Peter Wingard, really. So, yeah.
who is sometimes evil, as in Flash Gordon, but always fabulous.
Oh my God, yes.
Hang on, we're talking about Peter Wingard, the actor.
Yeah.
Or, okay, not the guy clearly inspired by him facially, who seduces Jean Grey in the Dark Phoenix saga.
Jason Wingard.
Combined
his character.
Of course. Yeah, yes, right? Jason Wingard. I understood that reference. I see what you did there, Claremont.
Oh, Claremont, you British weeb. A self-declared honorary British person.
Anglophile, at least.
Yeah,
While my wife is very much an Anglophile, she would not declare herself an honorary Brit, despite the fact she is married to one.
Well, yeah, it's a weird thing to say. I think for Claremont as well, it was something about old-timey sensibilities or saying something vaguely inappropriate. I was like, mate, I'm English and I wouldn't.
Yeah, both Chris Claremont and John Byrne have that very American attitude to being from another country.
Well, he was here a bit when he was younger. So yeah, aside from glorious evil weasel guy and getting shot into space, it's that kind of thing where I forgot that was the premise until it was launched and was laughing like a madman when that happened. I was like, what? What on earth? Okay, that's what the premise is now. I'm on board, you know, because you have to be for that sort of thing. It's like, yeah, this is such a ludicrous idea. It makes no sense even then, but let's go with it.
So shall we start with, I would say, the episode which has like our biggest, the big draw, Deaths of a Dominion, which was written by Anthony Topailoff and Elizabeth Burroughs, directed by Charles Crichton, who did a lot of Ealing comedies back in the 40s and 50s, and also directed A Fish Called Wanda. In the 80s, and he did a lot of TV work, including this one. And this also guest stars one of my favorite British actor persons, who, because again, you put the kibosh on hashtag Blake's Boys, and I have no desire to talk about Trial of a Time Lord on this show. This might be one of the few chances we get to talk about the one, the only, the shoutiest, the beardiest, the hawk maniest, the boss nassiest, Brian Blessed.
Oh my God. It's always a joy to see him. And he is very young here. Yeah, it was very odd seeing him that young. But also, you celebrate Brian Blessed. But there is another actor guest starring in this.
Oh yes, of course.
Somehow out-hams even Brian Blessed. Like, this is a man with enough like theatre training and Shakespearean acting under his belt to really ham it up to the point of saying lines like, "That unforgiving eye beheld the birth of Caesar about the moon." What a line! What a fucking line! John Shrapnel. What a legend. He is all over the place.
and that's actually, that's not his stage name. That is his actual God-given name, John Shrapnel.
Yeah, he is born of shrapnels. Two shrapnel parents there. That was incredible to see. That is a real name.
Yes. But
yeah, he was an actor who got a lot of work, and I can see why with this kind of performance. So, yeah. Deaths of a Dominion is incredible. And when I pressed play on ITVX, which is where I was streaming this, it put up a little, contains mild horror. And I was like, yeah, no shit, guys. I've seen one episode and I get it. Yeah, these two are kind of dressed like cavemen almost, or like medieval peasants, but, you know, scrubbed up a bit better. And playing it like the hammiest Shakespearean actors, when they see Earth's moon getting close, which must be weird. Like, don't get me wrong, most of the people the moon bumps into are wrong-uns, but it's going to be a disorientating moment for any of them doing that.
And also, it doesn't help that these people are from Earth.
Yeah.
So, they're just, I guess they just have their space sensors, and they're like, is that the fucking moon? What the fuck, guys? You have one job, moon, and that's to stay in orbit around the Earth.
Apparently not anymore, as they are, yeah... What is it?
Ultima Thule, which is like, I swear that's a name from a Conan story.
Yeah, it's definitely got things, got connotations, because the yellow submarine multiversal ship in Final Crisis that Grant Morrison created and had like people going into the limbo of unused comic characters was the Ultima Thule. As well.
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
Of course.
Yeah, it was hearing that name. I was like, yeah, GMOZ has definitely seen Space 1999 just in general with all of these concepts. And, you know, it made me want to reread The Nameless by them, which, again, nice cosmic horror.
I don't think I could reread The Nameless. There are very few Grant Morrison comics from this, like, nope, I am not reading that ever again. Usually it's on a case of quality, because even Grant Morrison, a writer who I love, has put out some not great work.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would reread The Filth over Nameless.
Wow. So, yeah, Filth I've definitely reread a few times. But, yeah. Ultima Thule has... not just these two, although you'd be surprised to learn there are other people who are also dressed kind of caveman slash slightly fancier village peasant wise. And they're definitely up to something. You know, when our crew arrive and they are going through all foam bubble snow, which apparently burnt the skin of Martin Landau, like the fumes from the ice cave and the fake snow, he just wasn't having any of it with that, which again, it's that thing of, yeah, there was no such thing as health and safety back then, was there?
No, they're probably just breathing in just pure asbestos.
Oh god, yeah, so many extras that were only in that set, but in that set for a long time. Yeah, never worked again after there. Never heard from after it. But yeah, so like they get a warm greeting at first. And there is a surprising amount of women here that aren't like, well, like John Shrapnel's playing. You know, in fact, no one is. He seems to be like a medieval fool. I think he got the notes of player court jester here. And Brian Blessed, bless him, is a bit more subtle in this, especially because he seems to be a bit more aware of what's gone on in this place, what they've been doing, than, was it Jack Tanner, Shrapnel's character? I forget the name of Brian Blessed's. Dr. Cabot Rowland.
Of course.
Sure. It turns out this place is unsurprisingly shady, as they've been experimenting with immortality. They've been around for a long time, but they can't have any kids. They can't continue their lines. They are just, you know, constant.
Entropica.
Yeah. And they're trying to, like, they've been experimenting on their people, creating a down below that's all full of weird, stumbling, living dead, kind of zombie looking people who are like, well, you know, they gave their lives, they donated this to them, and we got to honor them a bit for that. But also, it's a bit shady, all of that.
It's like, oh man, we have these people, and it's really sad that they sacrificed themselves for science. Really, really sad. Right. Immortality, anyone.
Yeah, which some of the crew are like, ooh, immortality, you say? Well, that sounds good. Like, this place, it's a bit of a fixer-upper. It's a bit icy, you know? But, immortality could be good.
Everyone is down on immortality except for Koenig.
Of course, because he can never be wrong.
No.
He's like, no, stop it. You're thinking of having fun. All of these women that stepped off a Conan set, they're distracting you, obviously. And, like, Captain Tanner, with all his wacky japes, it turns out Tanner was also experimented on and went a bit weird.
And in the end, it comes down to they're going to have a democratic vote of whether or not the people of Moonbase Alpha will stay and accept immortality, or all remain on Moonbase Alpha to inevitably die. Koenig, agrees to the majority rule, and Brian Blessed, Dr. Cabot Roland, is like, I will come with you all to go on about our impotent fuck colony of immortal gods. And so they all get on the Eagle and they take off to fly back to Moonbase One. And what happens to Brian Blessed?
Ooh, he turns into a juicy skeleton covered in bits.
Brian Blessed melts.
Yeah, I assumed it was like all of the years catching up all at once kind of thing. Like, he getting off of that, off of Ultima Thule, just ended whatever effect kept him alive.
And yeah.
Yeah, now they've got a real grim looking kind of weird skeleton.
It's kind of, did you expect to see something so graphic?
No. In this science fiction show for children, I did not. I see why. What, this has a TV-14 rating?
Because how we talk about how like disturbing the body horror threshold is. Threshold ain't got shit, because this guy, I would say he melts in the same way the Nazis do in Raiders of the Lost Ark, where like his skin has sloughed off, and he is just gore. And he is gore, gristle, and a bit. It's actually kind of like Hellraiser.
Yeah. Yeah, and it won't be the only time we'll mention Hellraiser tonight as well. Weirdly.
Just Brian Blessed doesn't do well in space, because in Blake 7, he gets teleported out into space and explodes. While still screaming that he is a god.
Oh, okay. Good. Yeah. To be honest, I could see that as the fate of this character if he hadn't have, got all mushy, wet, skeletonized. And then, of course, in Star Wars, he had to be boss Nass, which, when I met him, he was shockingly proud of.
He gets work.
He does.
It's not one of his greatest roles, say, Voltan, King of the Hawkmen in the 80s Flash Gordon, where he is having so much fun.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, he's glorious in that.
I expect that with Brian Blessed in Flash Gordon, he is dressed in like a bondage harness with cardboard wings. And I think he's expecting the Vice Squad to break down the door and shut down production at any moment. And he's just like, right, I am going to earn my paycheck and love every minute of it.
Yes, and he definitely does.
So how would you rank Deaths of a Dominion out of 5?
It's a tricky one, because there are some great moments. It feels like Martin Landau is a bit too... No, I know this is obviously shady. It's like, I want... Like, show me your workings.
Yeah.
I know they're shady. I've seen these stories before, but I don't know. I think it'd probably get like a 3 or a 4 from me. Because it's got some great acting. It did feel like it maybe went on a little longer than it needed to for the payoff. And Brian Blessed, surprisingly subtle. Especially that last bit, but, skeletons can't talk, can they?
Not without the right drugs.
True.
Yeah, I would definitely have to agree. Like, I wouldn't say this is the best episode that we watched for tonight. But it's got some fantastic acting from Blessed and Shrapnel. The greatest BBC light entertainment double accents, Cannon and Ball.
Oh, I'd love to see that. Like, the two of them doing some kind of light entertainment show. The next one we had was Dragon's Domain. And this was by Christopher Penfold, and, well, written by Christopher Penfold and directed by Charles Crichton once again. And we're both fans of Garth Marenghi's Dark Place. We've made that abundantly clear in the regular Casual Trek episodes. And this had some wonderful cosmic horror, but also felt very Dark Place at times.
Yeah.
Especially with the tentacle monster.
So apparently in 1996, in the far future of space 1996, we had this ace in, you know, this ace pilot, Tony Cellini, who led a mission to Ultra and encountered a graveyard of ships. On docking on one of these ships, his crew, one of whom is Mr. Bronson from Grange Hill.
Huh?
The sole bloke in the Tash.
Oh wow.
You'd recognize him because he's one of the admirals who Vader kills. I think he's the first admiral Vader kills in Empire Strikes Back.
Huh?
I can't remember his name. Is it Pietro Viers?
But
yeah, Michael Shard. But like any British kid of our generation will recognize him as the strict toupee wearing Mr. Bronson in Grange Hill. Possibly the one drama TV school with a higher body count than Degrassi Junior High.
Yep.
And a creature comes on board, which kills everyone but Tony Cellini. Now, Charlie, can you describe this creature?
Yes. So, again, I've got on my notes here, this, like, the ship graveyard, the probe, all of these things had such a mothership vibe. And then they look at this thing that looks like they've transposed a kind of swirling silvery bunch of, like, I don't know, paper or something, getting spinning round and round and getting closer, and suddenly it's like a giant bundle of tentacles with a big flashlight as a single kind of eye almost. But in its first appearance there, it is this huge terrifying thing. It's mostly dark here, it's not entirely on panel, on frame all the time, because it's so big and strange and the area they're in so confined. And it was like, oh shit, is this like some Lovecraftian monster that has been summoned here? Because it felt exactly that, like they are driven mad there.
It's a screaming morph.
Yeah.
The visage of, like, the tentacles and that one eye is terrifying enough. Mm. But then just, it's a perpetually just this discordant screaming.
Oh, it's amazing.
As it sucks the crewmen up and then immediately just spits out desiccated corpses. It doesn't help. The corpses are pushed out on a little cart with wheels. You can't see it, but just the way they're just kind of pushed out, it's a little bit unintentionally amusing. Tony is the sole survivor and is discredited by everyone. We get a lot of flashbacks to Earth and in 1996, where Koenig and the professor are trying to vouch, like, maybe this guy did see a draft. Maybe this guy did see a fucking space shog off. And Helena Russell's like, nah, he clearly went mad, abandoned his crew, ate his feet, got lost, died.
Yeah.
To quote Dark Place.
I guess this is one of a few times that Koenig's wrong about something. See, he is like, yes, this man, I know he's been disgraced. I know he's been kind of, you know, booted out and all that. But I trust him for Moonbase Alpha and our flying moon, which turns out to be wrong. Because even though it felt like about maybe half the episodes in flashback, showing how both Dr. Russell and Commander Koenig have previous with Cellini. In the present, he's flipping out. He's having some problems. He's fighting a possibly imaginary shimmering light with an axe, because he has an axe in his quarters. That's a thing for later. He gets deemed an unstable individualist. This is all happening because they're about to come upon that exact spaceship graveyard and the weird hell planet of Ultra. Again, feels very Morrisonian. Or was it a different planet and graveyard? But
I think it's the they implied that the graveyard had also shifted through space.
See, I figured it was they'd hit that kind of place. Whatever it is, there is a ship graveyard now, and this thing is back. It's like it attacks in the dark, and that's probably for the best, because this is when it goes full Garth Marenghi, when you've got the kind of battle between Cellini and the tentacles of the beast, and he ends up just knifing it in the orb.
You love it when a sci-fi show goes, yeah, we have our super advanced phaser weapons. Okay, in space 1999, they look like staple guns to hanging up some, putting up some drywall.
Oh yeah, I've definitely used those staple guns in a comic shop back in the day.
The universe is a dark and terrifying place and can create creatures and monstrosities that are impervious to laser blasts. But you know what a shock off will get, what will stop a shock off in its track?
Is it Martin Landau with an axe?
It's an axe to the fucking eye.
Hell yeah.
That's the one thing Star Trek never... I don't think Star Trek has ever given us a moment where our hero character just goes ham crazy with a hand axe.
No, they seemed conflicted about the murder of a space amoeba last time until it made clear that maybe it's just a disease in space. And it's like, oh, good, let's destroy it then. These guys, no, just fucking axe to the face. Alien life might have been peaceful, might have just been an animal, but it's...
Fuck it. Just axe to the face. It's, to be fair, every single alien creature I think they have them encounter on this show, they never meet anyone nice. So I guess after a while, they're like, yeah, they're either going to kill us, harvest our organs, or try and Japanese hentai us. So you know what? We got to meet it with one hand open and the other hand has a fucking axe behind the back.
Yeah. With this episode, I did like some of the props that they had as well. You could tell we're in the future because the game of checkers used yellow and orange Starburst as the pieces. And even the coin, because it was a coin flip determining who would go out on the probe between Cellini and Koenig. And even that was like a weird kind of black and yellow kind of squared thing as well. Yes, the other thing I had on my notes was, when Cellini looks like he's being unstable, it's like, oh, how could he be sane? He went to go outside into space and didn't even take his toothbrush. So yeah, obviously he's mad.
The most British line in this British show.
alas, Cellini does not survive against the thing. But one less cosmic horror out in space.
Like, I feel like Space 1999 gets it. I think the thing we keep talking about on the show is that, you can dress space up with like a nice, you could build a spaceship. You can give it like some nicer mottled marble effects on the walls. You can give it some nice carpeting. You can put in a bar. You can put in a gymnasium.
Some nice wood paneling.
Yeah, we're going to have a table. We're going to have meetings. We're going to have Tai Chi classes, which is all really to distract you from the fact that space is goddamn terrifying.
Yeah.
And it will kill you.
Definitely. It's become increasingly clear that's what space in Star Trek's like. And Space 1999 seems to have made that abundantly clear and actively hostile against life, really.
We're going to be as scientific and cold and methodical and hard science about this, but we're just going to keep running into fucking shock-offs every week.
Yeah. God. Goddamn shock-offs.
Shock-offs. Shock-offs. So, yeah, again, out of 5, how would you put... did you keep accidentally calling this Dragon's Den? Like, the BBC TV show? Okay, that was just me then.
I kept mixing this and Death's Other Domain because of all the Ds. It's it was good fun. And that thing of, okay, I guess that monster is the dragon, in that kind of, you know, here be dragons sort of thing. Mm.
So out of five, how would you put this one?
I mean, I think this is pretty close to a five for me.
Yeah.
Like, this is exactly that Mothership style space horror madness, but with the interesting tone of also being a Gerry Anderson joint. And I love that disparity.
I feel like I do need to praise that, like, this show was clearly shot on film and was... It's high budget. It doesn't look as cheap as Classic Trek does a lot. And it never looks as cheap as Doctor Who is. Like, you know, this was done by ITC, who did a lot of the spy shows, like The Saint, The Persuaders, The Prisoner. So this was a company who always had one eye on the international market, which is probably why we have two kind of semi-big name Americans as our leads. These are really high, you know, we're kind of glossing over the, I'd say that sometimes the show looks far more impressive than it has any right to be.
Yeah, definitely. It's been good fun. And yes, that's Dragon's Domain. And next, we've got another kind of D-type thing with the Mission of the Darians.
And this was written by Johnny Byrne, who did do some Doctor Who in the 80s.
No relation to John Byrne, guy that's a bit of a jerk, despite having done some nice art in the early 80s.
And directed by Ray Austin. And hey, guess what? Moonbase Alpha has encountered a spaceship. It's like 5 miles long, and they're beaming a distress call. There can be no drawbacks to going on board and exploring this ship.
Look, at some point they're going to have to hit a nice one. Sadly, it's not here.
No.
There's an emergency message going out, going, oh my god, there are thousands of dead. Oh, come help. Okay, let's go. It can't be worse than last time, right? And yeah, head on in. The place looks like a wreck, even though there are some interesting, like, arty panels on some of the walls, which look like, you know, they've got maybe a graffiti artist to do some panels for an office building or something. You know, that sort of tone to it. Yeah, we even get some mute little people who they see for a moment, like, oh my god, people! And there are some lights on the floor. For a second, I thought, oh my god, like Sapphire and Steel. But no, these are just torches with weird astronaut-looking guys.
Have you had a chance to watch some Sapphire and Steel yet?
Yeah, for that exact one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I finished the first case. I will press on, especially because I am now running Monster of the Week. And I'm curious to see if any of it kind of permeates through into what I'm doing.
A show which is clearly shot on no money.
Yes, very much on no money. But yeah, this, like, they start to see there are some weird things going on. We even get Joan Collins in a kind of Midsommar-inspired hat, which is ludicrous in its design. And an explanation of, yeah, that broadcast from like 900 years ago and 14 people survived, which doesn't seem like the kind of thing where you could keep that going for that long, which yeah you can't, as it turns out, and there are a lot more shady dealings going on.
It would be a shame if the 14 of us had to survive by horrific unnatural means, which we undertook with great trepidation, and we feel really bad about doing it for 900 years. It would be a shame if we were forced to drastic measures to survive.
Yeah, especially if we had to tell anyone about it or own up to any of this. Because, you know, when you say it out loud, it sounds a bit bad, what we've been doing.
So we basically have set ourselves up in two distinct casts. We have the Trogs, who are all savages, and we have given them a god. And the fact that God looks like our leader of a group we call the elites, and we make sure that the Trogs root out any kind of genetic impurities and sacrifice themselves to us so we can harvest their organs. That's not bad at all. Everyone does it. It's a metaphor for capitalism.
Yeah, and we've got this nice little tray of little multicolored goo, which is, you know, I guess their records. It's what's left. Anyone that has a race bank, you know, is going to be problematic as hell.
You're taking this all out of context. We're actually really nice people. It's just that people who believe us as gods are dedicated to find anyone who's impure. They're going to call mutant and then put in a disintegration capsule. But it's a nice disintegration capsule. I feel really bad for that one extra who came across on a landing party who just had I don't know if it was like a birth defect in his fingers or he had lost them in an accident. But yeah, they find the guy and they immediately call MUTANT and put him in the death cap. That part was of wild.
It was. So the away team's kind of split into two. So you get some talking to your Joan Collins fancy kind of elites, and then the Trogs, this poor extra who is put into the disintegrator.
Mutant!
And of course Dr. Russell is fine. It's like, yes, she'll do. Like, she's not a mutant, but we will dress her. Like, once again, they've got the outfits of a kind of barbarian film or something like that, which, looking online, apparently Barbara Bain had some complaints about Joan Collins' skirt, going, you can see a lot of her legs, I want a shorter skirt. The director, like, that's kind of why we hired Joan. So she ended up in the kind of barbarian outfit.
Oh god, I love bitchy actor ego. How have we not mentioned that Joan Collins is actually in Star Trek? She plays Edith Keeler in City on the Edge of Forever. And then Pawntash Paul gets something to do. He gets to uncover a whole corrupt religion and do some very nice jumping through some doors.
It felt like this is one where they kind of could feel going in, the vibes were bad on this floating arc. And yeah, understandably so. It did feel like at one point Koenig trying to get them to stop fighting, and in my mind it was just like, yeah, it feels like you should go, why can't you fuckers just be normal?
Stop it.
You're being weird. You're all weird out here. Just stop it and be normal for a change. Because
you're
he was
all
so fed
immortal
up
and crazy.
Yeah. Instead, one of the elders gets shoved right through the race bank. Yeah, all their shit gets fucked up, especially when they're like...
It turns out that when you make yourself God of an entire collection of people, when they find out that God is a grift, they don't take it well. And, oh no, your race bank got smashed. You've got purple food colouring all over the place.
Can't help but imagine it just went to hell from here. Just... like purge.
I think
level.
This might be the most Captain Kirk Koenig ever really gets, because he's like, you two, Trogs and Elite, must work together. We can't stay and help. We're on a time limit. So we're just going to say, hey, you got to work together, and then we're going to leave.
I did like when the god in the astronaut outfit was unmasked. It was a youth who looked exactly like the live-action version of the pimply-faced teen from The Simpsons. Like, specifically, get your most ineffectual-looking one of the elites. And yeah, just, whoop, there's your god. Like, please, sir! I'm sorry for being a god!
Have you ever had to pretend to be God?
I've pretended to be someone's manager, and I pretended to be my deceased employer at the comic shop a few times. Sometimes, mostly when he was alive. Because we all took turns being Dave when people came in. But occasionally people would come in even after he'd passed and asked to speak to Dave. And it was just easier go, yeah, I'm Dave. What do you want? Yeah, I'm Dave.
Given how Dave ran that place, I am very unsurprised that there weren't any kind of Weekend at Bernie's-esque shenanigans with his corpse.
Well, luckily, no. Luckily, I saw that go in the ground. I did lose my dice bag in the hole. But, yeah.
Can I ask, did you put a stake through his heart just to make sure?
No. It just put a confusing book near him or something. For a man who ran a book and comic shop, the level of illiteracy was impressive. Yeah. Anyway, on that note.
Wait. Mission of the Durians. How do you rank this one out of 5?
Yeah, I think probably a 4. Like, this was great fun. It did remind me a little of the underground cult with the weird gods will make me think of the cat people in Red Dwarf, of like how utterly brutal and horrific a lot of that must have got.
Red Dwarf has some space 1999 kind of vibes in which you have like the least qualified people being forced into the role of space heroes, and also they can never meet anyone nice. I think there was even a point in Red Dwarf when Crichton lampshades it and just goes, why can't we meet anyone nice?
And that's fair, really.
You're never going to meet anyone nice,
as it turns out. And then our last one is End of Eternity, also written by Johnny Byrne and directed by Ray Austin, who, just having a quick look at his Ray Austin's credits, I didn't realise he was also a stunt double for Martin Landau in North by Northwest. Oh. Yeah, I don't know if he stepped into it for this as well, but that's cool.
Okay, he did some episodes of the original Randall Hopkirk Deceased. Ooh, he did some episodes of V, which is an 80s guilty pleasure of mine. Let's see.
And of course, Police Academy the series.
Oh, wow, how could I forget Police Academy the series? Ooh, he directed an episode of Airwolf, a show I've never seen, but like that opening theme is some fantastic synth. Magnum PI. Oh, that's wow.
The Return of the Man from U.N.C.L.E. The 15 Years Later Affair.
Wow. He was a second unit director on the British film Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, which is a kitchen sink drama which stars a very young Albert Finney.
Oh.
Which just kind of seems completely at odds with the rest of this guy's CV. You know, good for you, Ray Austin. You had a career.
Yeah, you did a lot of stuff. So, End of Eternity, when you gave me the list, I was like, so is this going to be the finale? This is
no.
Just still part of the first season. None of these are of the second season, even. So, yeah, what's the deal with the End of Eternity, Mars?
Well, they found an asteroid. They found a big asteroid, which actually has an atmosphere.
Oh.
So an Eagle crew goes across, including our latest doomed Eagle pilot crewman of the series, who really likes to fly, given his bedroom setup.
What might?
They break open the vault, and they find a dead guy, and also some really grotesque paintings.
Yeah.
Paintings of people screaming in terror and impaled faces. And stuff that looks like, you know, would be covers of Clive Barker novels in the 80s, like proper splatterpunk. So they find this guy, and he's dead, and they find this horrific art, and they're like, should we bring this guy back with us? You know, this seems fine. It's not as if the other people we've met in space have tried to kill us, harvest our organs, tentacle us. Let's just bring him back.
Well, he's dead. He can't hurt us. It's fine.
Then he's dead. He's covered in blood. And then he gets better. Unlike the Mike, the Eagle pilot, who is now permanently grounded because, you know, he looked at an explosion and got some retinal damage. Poor Mike. Pour one out for Mike.
Yeah, poor Mike. He seemed so enthusiastic about flying.
Yeah. He liked playing with his boy, biplane. But then the alien recovers, and he is 7 foot tall. He has, like, the most 70s haircut, and he's an indestructible immortal. Yet another one. take a drink.
Yep.
And he's called Balor. And what is Balor's deal? What's his gig?
Oh my. Well, guess what? It's immortality again.
Oh goody.
Yeah. He looks like a budget cultist, really. With very kind of big sleeves and legs and that. But yeah, he admits, yeah, basically, once my people were mortal like you, and we basically tried to stop the immortality after a while because people weren't living full enough lives, and death is what gives people meaning. And he's giving a lot of villain vibes while he says this about how he took the immortality away and was cast out to suffer eternal solitude for it. And they do say, what about those paintings? Because those were the paintings of a crazy person. So, oh no, they're not mine. Honestly, they're just there. It's all worrying, especially given the whole unkillable immortal thing. And, you know, he wants to share the fun.
Charlie, can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
Is this idea of fun mass killing?
Well, yes. Yeah.
Is he a goddamn psychopath?
I thought you were going to say, is he a Cenobite? Like, he's certainly got that kind of, ooh, it's not just death that I want. I want to cause suffering. You know, it's all very Hellraiser talk. You know, he's obviously loves experimenting with pain of other people, of course.
Of other people, yeah.
Yeah, and expects them to agree to it. And it's like, either let me torture and kill pretty much everyone here, or I'll just kill everyone here. As you can tell, that's a difficult choice.
You've got a bit where he talks to Mike, the grounded eagle pilot, and makes him start bashing Koenig's face in with a plane. Which was quite a well shot sequence. Again,
fucking hell, that was brutal.
This is the other thing that Star Trek, the original series, doesn't have, which is really good, like, camera work and actual attempts at filmmaking, and not just, hey, we're gonna point a camera at you, go.
Yeah, yeah, it does feel quite visceral, seeing a newly insane Mike battering the lead character of this show into unconsciousness with a toy plane. That was impressive to see.
So basically, Mike beats Koenig to a bloody pulp and then dies doing the jazz hands and scary face.
Yeah, it's not a nice episode for Mike.
No, and then Balor walks in, heals Koenig's wounds because we see a gigantic puddle of blood where Koenig had been. And I guess that this was basically Balor's idea of a job interview. It's like, hey, so this is what I'm planning to do. This is my gig. This is my deal. Now, do we have an agreement? Do you like it? Do you want to do this? What? Yes/no. And Koenig is understandably, no. 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 You're weird. Stop being weird.
Yeah, unfortunately, he will not stop being weird. Instead, he'll start pulling up bits of machinery, smashing things in a bit of a fit. He's very upset. He's, you know, he's like a spoilt kid that's not allowed to do what he wants.
And so Balor just kind of marches off. I did like how he's always shot in a way that makes him just look like a creeping shadow just through the pristine, like, cleanness of Moonbase Alpha. I don't know if he's wearing some fantastic 70s like elevator shoes to make him just look freakishly tall.
He must do. The actor quickly looked up. Peter Bowles is 6'2". So, you know, he's tall, but
yeah,
he is freakishly big. And the way he just picks people up and flings them about, it's like they're toys. You know, it's incredible to see the kind of, like, sometimes he's not even going to kill anyone because he wants to do the whole pain thing first. But if anyone gets in his way, it's just fling.
Fling, there they go. Spin them around. At one point, he gets attacked by an entire security team. And then there's a great bit of like stunt coordination, which once I saw it, I couldn't unsee it, in which he knocks one guy onto the floor and another guy jumps up, you know, uses the security officer on the floor as a steppy stool to jump onto him. And the moment I saw this little bit of stunt work, I'm like, I can't unsee this now, because it is so clearly something they planned out while blocking that it wouldn't just happen. It is one of those little bits of like theatrical stage fighting, which is so completely unrealistic. It's like something from the WWF. It's like, okay, we have planned. It's like with like Kirk's style of fighting in the original Trek, which is double fist punch. You jump off the wall. You know, it's good old grand, the old grand tradition of all space fighters were trained in the old arts of wrestling.
Yeah, it's good fun. And yeah, he does briefly go over to Dr. Russell going, hey, care to join me in any of this? She's like, nope. And he kills her assistant. And it's like, oh, well, yeah, he's just going to keep doing this, isn't he? So they do have to come up with a plan to deal with this immortal, unkillable bastard. And Koenig has an idea, which is, there are a lot of stickers, like flimsy looking stickers. He tries clipboarding them away, but ends up just peeling them off the airlocks that say danger airlock, and yeah, crumples them up. You can see how flimsy they are.
Again, I think this is your very British sensibilities at work, because you know, I'm sure like an American show would be like, oh, we're just gonna trick him and shoot him repeatedly into the airlock, whereas in Space 1999 in England, it's like, okay, We're gonna remove the safety stickers. We're gonna remove both safety stickers, and hope he's not been paying attention.
Gonna keep that fire door open. Yeah.
We're gonna save the day with an OSHA violation.
We're gonna mislabel those fire extinguishers. Someone that's been through too much fire safety training. Like, I think it's every 6 months I've had to do that for about 12 years now.
When I worked at the Hilton, every 6 months we had to have fire training. And they tried their best to kind of, you know, change it up. But no, it's just like, you know, you go in and you just want to go, okay, don't start any fires. Don't block fire doors. Yes, can I go now? Am I certified yet? And so, yep, Koenig decides to, you know, meet this guy Bello mano a mano in an open airlock, and just kind of every so often just kind of look towards the door to make sure, okay, it's not open yet, not dangerous at all.
That took a bit more doing than I thought it would, of a kind of, oh god, he needs to get out of there so we can space this guy, and everyone's kind of tensely there with the big airlock button waiting for the moment that Koenig can dive out, press the button, and shoot the bastard into space, where I assume he is just dying forever, given the immortality.
You know what? Good.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I'd be like, oh, that's rough. That's undeserved. But yeah, this guy, it does feel like...
Look, I feel like the space amoeba got more compassion than from Star Trek than Baylor does. Because, like, this guy's a dickhead. Let's space him.
Oh my god, he's such a jerk. He's entertaining, but a real jerk. And they even do a flyby of his asteroid and blow it up just for the hell of it.
But then the asteroid comes back because the rock was also regenerating as well, as we saw earlier.
Yeah. So, yeah. That was fun. What do you reckon, rating-wise, for this one?
I am going to say... Like, I might give this a 5.
Yeah.
Because, like, there's some good camera work. Like, the guy playing Baylor is just physically imposing. Again, really good camera work. Just make him just look just terrifying at all times.
Well, for a guy who, he looks very 70s. Looking at his credits, he did a lot of sitcom work, like To the Man Aboard and all that. And he does look like that, but they still managed to frame him in a brilliantly, like, manic. Again, he's got that Hellraiser vibe. Or like, did you ever read Legion Lost?
Yes, I read it a few years. I read it during COVID.
Okay, so spoilers for Legion Lost for anyone that may have the instinct for reading Legion of Superheroes.
And then I loved like the bit when, you know, it's like, whatever happened to his society? I wonder what happened to his society. And then it just cuts to the paintings and you just hear the scream.
I think we know.
Yeah.
Again, those paintings felt like they belonged on like a sapphire and steel or something. But Legion Lost comparison. So, big spoiler for the Legion Lost maxi series, which is amazing. But they get the Legion of Superheroes have gone through hell, and a bunch of them got blown up on their headquarters, which was up in space, got sucked into somewhere that is beyond our comprehension of space. And they all get they all wake up from crystalline pods and all this. And there's this monster called the Progenitor that's doing all these horrific things. And by the end of the series, they realize the Progenitor was one of them, was Element Lad, who was sweet and naive originally, but he was there for like beyond thousands of years. He has seen evolution. He has caused evolution in things, in germs, making life forms. And in his eyes, it is just a blink and a species is gone, to the point where he is exactly this kind of cold. And it is horrifying to see on an existential level, to go, these people that loved you, that were your friends, and just rendering one of them into goo with a thought. It's like, oh fuck, what do we do with this unkillable immortal thing? And I've definitely got Progenitor kind of vibes from Baylor here, who you do get that thing of immediately, as soon as he's there, Hellraiser vibes, evil cultist vibes. We know this guy's deal.
Yeah, the moment he wakes up and he's wearing all black, and we found him in a cave surrounded by seventies horror covers, there are a few red flags. Like, first off,
yeah, just a few. Really, they should have left him there. Should have gone horrific paintings, dead body. Let's just not. We can not do this for once, guys.
The moment he said, "Oh yes, my race was immortal," they should have been like, "Right, okay, out, check, please."
Yep. Yeah, we're done here.
Nope, not again.
We've dealt with immortals before, and it never goes well.
So I'm going to give this one a 5 as well.
Yeah, I think it's definitely up there. So, like, you've seen Space 1999 before. Yeah, is this something you've seen like once? Is this something that's a regular visit?
I've seen a few episodes on and off. Like, I remember it being on in the 90s when I was a kid, and I did not like it because I would say this is definitely not for kids.
Yeah.
And it's not because of the horror elements, it's because it's just, you know, it's a very, I'm not going to say subtle, but it's a very kind of grounded show. It's not exciting in the way that Star Trek is when you're a kid. You're like, oh man, you got all these fun aliens and these fun characters, and there's like space battles and there's punching. This is just very much like Werner Herzog. In the cold darkness of space, there is only chaos and death. You cannot try and find love. You cannot try and find meaning. Every single day is a bitter conflict against the entropic nature of a harsh and caring universe.
Yeah, that's like somewhere between that kind of humdrum drudgery of surely the science fictionness of this is interesting enough, with some of the slower moments, and then spaceship graveyard, tentacle monster, people going mad, this fucking axe to the tentacle.
Like, this definitely came up post, like, the new wave, the British new wave of sci-fi. Which, I know I was talking before, which was more kind of inner space and went into much more kind of avant-garde directions. But where, like, you know, you had your 60s Star Trek, where you kind of have the post-war optimism, and you have the specter of Vietnam just kind of slowly edging in as the show continues. With Space 1999, it's just like, yeah, no, there is no joy to be had. And I did end up, I think this is one of my kind of COVID watches, okay. Especially after talking with Andy from Breakfast in the Ruins about the show. I did kind of give it, kind of watch a few episodes. This is not just kind of like, this show is, is continuously more like horror vibes.
I did wonder if you'd curated the list.
Oh, like there is one with like an evil, fast-growing space child. There's space ghosts, which aren't coast to coast. Oh. Yeah, like, there. You know, this is pretty much how the show kind of goes on.
Cool.
Like, there is horror and just terror everywhere to be found.
So, personally, I've seen 5 episodes of this show. I did watch them in a chronological order from what you gave me, even though they're not consecutive episodes. And I definitely think I will watch more.
Okay. Like,
this was fun. It was not always good, but often bonkers enough to be very enjoyable. I know I'm running Monster of the Week at the moment, and I like watching things and reading things that are vaguely in the line of what I'm running, role-playing game-wise. And I want to run Alien after that, and I'll definitely be running Mothership at some point in the future. And I think Space 1999 might have to be something I watch for both of those, because it fits the vibe nicely, especially for Mothership.
I have grown to enjoy this show.
Mm.
As I've gotten older, my tastes have, you know, kind of branched out, especially as I've experienced more kind of horror fiction.
Yeah.
And do you feel like, in talking about cosmic horror, do you feel like Space 1999 fit the assignment of this is cosmic horror on a weekly TV show in a way that Star Trek really never would?
It feels that way, yeah. Because I feel Star Trek didn't intend as much cosmic horror as it had. This, it feels like they must have known with some of these. Mm. Like with Baylor and with the weird terror from space kind of thing. They are channeling like proper horror with it all. And good. I'm always a fan of that sort of thing.
And like, I wonder if it's just part of just kind of like just the mood of the decade.
Maybe.
And like, you know, because we get Star Trek The Motion Picture, which has very similar vibes to the aesthetic of 2001 and to this.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, given that there was a planned Star Trek Phase 2 TV show, which was going to happen in the 70s, I wonder if it was just kind of a mood that was just kind of disseminating. Like, what would a Star Trek TV series have looked like in a post-Vietnam, post-Watergate, post-Nixon era?
God, I'd have loved to have seen that. That would have been very good fun.
Like, Phase 2 was announced in June 77, so who knows, because Star Wars kind of did away with the kind of like the grimness, because like, you know, you got the films of Sims like Death Race 2000, you've got Soylent Green, the Omega Man, which also has its mutants and Rollerball. So maybe it's just like a dystopian vibe, and Logan's Run, of course. Then, you know, a little film called Star Wars came along and said, hey, it's okay for space to be fun and exciting and swashbuckling, and we can just, you know, we could just keep trying to recapture that vibe of a recaptured Americana. Hmm. For better or worse.
Yeah.
I love Star Wars, but there's always part of me which is like, man, Star Wars kind of really set back science fiction, especially on big screen TV, by about 30 years.
Yeah. It's like Dark Knight Returns and Watchmen. And these are two very good things that caused a lot of shit to happen as well. Oh, well. But yeah, this wasn't one of them. This was good fun. Definitely recommend if you want some very retro science fiction and some bizarre storylines. Like, this was a lot weirder than I thought it was going to be. So I'm coming out of this a lot happier.
Good. I am glad. I do recommend that you should check out the UFO.
Yeah, I've heard it's bonkers.
It's bonkers alien hunting. Again, there's some classy stuff, but also it does have that hampered by bureaucracy, where it's like, yes, we're a top secret, highly advanced, very expensive alien hunting organization, but we still have to make sure that our paperclip budget is properly allocated. And also has an incredibly equally funky theme tune, because this, again, given the wah-wah pedalness of the theme tune, you don't expect the show to be this dark.
Oh, that theme tune was a bop. I was bopping along when it first came. I was like, oh, what's this? Yeah. And it was doing the kind of like BSG, this episode, horrific painting. What the fuck? Oh, bop along. It was very good fun.
Yeah, like that, you know, it starts off with a very muted kind of drum roll, fanfare. But yeah, I'm glad that you have enjoyed your foray into the world of Moonbase Alpha and Space 1999. Mm. I hope you do check out more. Still feeling hurt that you continue to slander Blake 7, so, but you know.
I mean, now it's just become a bit.
No, it is a bit. I admit it.
It's hit that point where there is, what is it, Be Kind Rewind is a DVD video shop in the open market. And they have all of Blake 7.
Wait, it's called Be Kind Rewind?
Yeah. Oh, no, sorry, it's not Be Kind Rewind. It's Stop, Look, Listen.
Oh, that's okay, it. Yeah.
Sorry, no, there was another one that was Be Kind Rewind that's no longer with us, like so many of them. But yeah, Stop, Look, and Listen is... It's where I've got a good amount of folk horror DVDs from. God, at the start of this show, I was saying they always have a Star Trek animated series box set there. That's my emergency that I can't bring myself to actually buy. But if it ever goes off of Paramount Plus, I know where it is.
Yeah.
And they've got a complete Blake 7 that I look at each time and go, no.
Now, I'll be honest, I imagine that you just kind of look at the Blake 7 and you just flip it off.
Yeah. I resist taking a photo and sending to you.
You're too kind.
Yeah. I go through there a lot, so yeah, that it would get really annoying really quickly. You know, it's not going to be annoying and was not over quickly. It was this episode.
Immortality in the Cold Vacuum of Space.
Oh, God, yeah. Again, that's going to be rough, but he did earn it.
He did earn it.
That's fine. Yeah, so next time we're back to Star Trek. And while we had some great episodes here, we're going to delve into some episodes that might be good. Some might be really bad. Yes, we're doing a Ferengi episode of Star Trek. Be prepared for some mixed things.
And just remember, Umox does not cause blindness.
And yeah, you can find us on ko-fi.com/casualtrek, where if you sling us some money, I don't even know if they have money in Space 1999. Oh yeah, if you fling us some weird black and white square coins, then we will accept a suggestion for an episode to cover, a theme to cover, anything along those lines. You can also find us as Casual Trek on Blue Sky, on BSky, what is it? casualtrek.bsky.social. Yes. And Miles, where can they find you?
They can find me on my blog at mareedlobato.wordpress.com. You can also find me on Blue Sky as milesreedlobato.bsky.social. As before, I was on yet another episode on Breakfast in the Ruins, and the second part of that episode is going to be recorded very soon. Unfortunately, we're doing it after the season finale of Doctor Who, where we're going to talk about the most recent season. So if this becomes a three-part episode, I won't be surprised at this point.
It's going to be a three-parter.
It's going to be a three-parter.
It's going to be a three-parter. And I applaud the madness of it.
Man, see, this is why we implement time limits on recapping shit on our show.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah.
And Charlie, where can they find you?
So, you can find me on Blue Sky at skyshark.bsky.social. I'm on itch.io, which is skyshark.itch.io, for games and such. Fake Tales for my blog. And Who Dares Rolls, where I've been doing a bit of the old games journalism. For any people that are interested in some Charlie lore, then my friend Sam has a podcast about Meatloaf called Chat Out of Hell. And he's been asking for people's Meatloaf memories. So you can see what act of potentially illegal vandalism I did using a Meatloaf cassette back in, the very early 2000s? Late 90s, early 2000s, I think, in the latest episode.
Was this your edgelord phase?
I mean, I was definitely a bit of a dick. I don't think I'd say full edgelord, just a bit of an arsehole. So yeah, check that out. Also, if you like Meatloaf and Jim Steinman, or if you don't and fancy listening to two stand-up comedians talk about them, then yeah, check that out.
And normally this would be the point where we say, go to a Starfleet and have a jelly baby. But since this was Space 1999, I'm just going to say, have a jelly baby and don't trust anyone who says they're immortal. And if they're an immortal and they want you to look at their art project, just politely decline and run.
To be honest, if you're on a moon hurtling through space, just don't go outside. Don't speak to anyone. They're all bad. They're all just really bad.
Turn off the lights and pretend you're not home.
Yeah.
You have been listening to Casual Trek, a Nerd and Tie podcast, presented by Charlie Etheridge-Nunn and Miles Reed-Lobato.